Hello and welcome to another episode of the How to Scale a Business podcast. My name is Hector Santia Esteban. I'm your host for today, and our special guest is Doug Gray. He's a family business and a change management expert, founder and owner of multiple variety companies, and someone who's been doing this for a number of decades. Doug, excited to have you on today. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Glad to be a resource.
If I'm being frank, if someone says, at least to the layman person, if you tell them that you're in change management, it's probably something that touches every person's life in some sort of degree. Or it's something that could be equal to every industry. But I'd love for you to break that down for the layman and what that is, and then catch us up a little bit on how you got into that field.
Yeah, I've never met a person who says, change me. Go ahead, Hector, change me. I've never met that person. Nobody likes to be changed, do they? And all of us live in a world where there's endless change. We're perpetually adapting to the weather and market situations and business and climate and people that we meet and all that. Subsequently, the question becomes, how do I manage my changes? Or what are the changes I want to embrace? And what are the ones I want to avoid? It's weird today, because I met somebody the other evening who said, I'm in change management. I said, really, what's that mean? I run an organizational leadership group at a Fortune 500 healthcare company. Great, what's that mean? She said, frankly, I don't know. We have so many CEOs and leadership gaps and transitions that it's different every day. I said, well, you must like that. She said, absolutely, I love that. Leadership is how we respond in vacuums, isn't it? When we don't know what to do next, we step in. So change management for her was not only embracing the technological impacts of our lives, but organizational and people and process and market and competitive, you name it. How's that for a ramble?
It's great context. I've heard it more and more really over the last couple of years. Is it a newer sort of field? Is it something that evolved from something else or emerged out of something else? Because you've been doing this for decades. So I'm curious if it's just something that's become trendy now. How might you speak to that?
It's a great question. And the short answer is I'm not sure if there's one source. If you go back in time a little bit, we've got 100 years of research on social science. In other words, we know what motivates people's behavior, and we tend to focus on the negative stuff, anxiety and depression and responses to violence. Since 1960, McKinsey and others introduced this phrase called management consulting. Did they originate it? No. Did they steal it from economists? Yes. Did it increase market share and create a brand? Absolutely. And countless consultants have subsequently followed and said, I'm a management consultant. It's like my previous example. What does that mean? So I think the short answer is there may not be an origin story. Sorry, Hector. I'm not qualified to provide one if there is one. And the rate of change has never been slower than it is today. You may know people who are freaked out by the impact of AI, let's say. If we think about evolutionary responses to external tools and stimuli and information, the rate of business today is as slow as it's going to be the rest of my career and the rest of your career. People don't embrace that. Often they say, it's too fast. I can't reply. I can't respond. I'm overwhelmed. I call that a limiting belief. There's no historical evidence for that. Just as before a trip, you'd find the energy to pack and be super productive in the last 24 hours prior to that trip. And you go on the expedition, you forget about all those important things. We find the energy to respond to change in different ways. I think change management is largely a response to the technological stuff that we can't really understand. I say that partly because so much of our exponential organizations, the work of Peter Diamandis and others that looks at how do technologies overlap. How does healthcare and AI overlap is just one example. How does finance and virtual tools overlap? How does cybersecurity and financial transactions overlap? These are examples of what's now called OpenXO or open exponential organizations. And the idea generally is that when two or more of those bigger organizations collide, we're going to have something bigger than the Gutenberg press. We're going to have something bigger than we can imagine, probably. And Diamandis is a futurist. He's the guy behind XPRIZE and other initiatives. Singularity University. So his opinion, and I'm leaning toward it, is that we need to embrace the changes that are impending, not with our heads down, not with fear, not cowering in response to change, but rather, what can I manage? What's within my domain? I call that internal locus of control. That's what business psychologists call it. External locus of control is all that other stuff that I'm really not able to reply to. If I do a better job of managing my responses to that stimuli, not only does it reduce anxiety and everything else, but it gives me a sense of efficacy or agency, which is a nerdy way of saying, I think I'm in control, which could be delusional, Hector, but I think I'm in control for that experience.
It's an interesting point that you bring up because I got my first job, not my first job, but I graduated high school and became self-employed in 2009 in a really interesting time. I got into the sales field right when the internet started to emerge. And there was this shift in sales that happened when all of a sudden the consumer had access to as much information as the salesperson, that all of a sudden that consultative type of selling became the thing that won as opposed to the shuckster or the one that just tried to pull one over on somebody, if you will. And privy to that kind of shift, shift. And what's also interesting is that with that and consumers, it also seemed that employees or people that work for you had a similar shift. There was a similar shift in how you would manage or lead somebody, where that almost that dictatorial-like leader didn't work anymore, right? I don't know what the politically correct term is, but the ship driver was that whole person who just had the whip and was cracking the whip. That sort of stuff wasn't working anymore. And then you layer on the pandemic and virtual and remote work and all this sort of stuff. To your point, I don't know that people have had the chance to catch up, to really take a breath of air. And then they've got their own personal lives that are probably in as much chaos as well. So it's just a big fireball that leaders are now forced to deal with. And I guess my question that's emerging here is that, are there any big mistakes that you think people are making with regards to this? Because they're not seeing the picture. They're not waking up and privy to this impending change that you've talked about.
Absolutely. And you demonstrated it nicely by using extreme language, violent language, explosive, destructive, fireball type language. We're fear-based, and that motivates most human behavior. We know that. But we also know in our prefrontal cortex, we like to give advice to one another. Why do you do podcasts? Why do we share advice with each other? Why do we turn to somebody and say, what advice do you have for me about? Well, the short answer is it's future-oriented, and it's always optimistic. If we were better at giving advice about how to respond to change, if we use that language more often, it'd be tremendous. But what do we do instead? Let me give you some negative feedback on the social media post. In fact, let me write some flaming whatever. We reinforce the negative, the fear-based stuff. So the short answer is it's a paradigm shift. The world of positive psychology is my dissertation research, and it's also my worldview. Essentially, if we asked, how could Hector flourish? The rest of today, just for today, how could Hector flourish? It begs questions like, what can you control? Everything from your physical, emotional, cognitive, and spiritual state to your activities. What do you say no to the rest of the afternoon? What do you say yes to? How well do you sleep? What do you eat? Who do you hang with, and how do you validate them? Just like I'm doing now, when we provide accurate, positive affirmations for others, we flourish. By analogy, it's the flowers growing out of a cement crack rather than a block of clay that's formed by some manager, like the one you just described, who says there's only one way for Hector to evolve in this career. Well, that's BS. To be clear, its dominant model, it's called a top-down authoritarian managerial model in many businesses, it needs to be. Why? Because we're able to look at hands and feet. We're able to look at operational metrics. My client this morning was an example of that. It's a manufacturing company. And what they're coming to realize is that in order to have more market impact, they've got to think collaboratively. Collaborative leadership is, in fact, a thing. I'd say it's how we've always evolved. If you think about every social institution you like, an example would be a church or a school or a museum or that neighborhood park. All of those are examples of collaborative ventures, right? Philanthropy. It's not just an American thing. It's a social force that drives and manifests the impact of family X or family Y. But why do we give to our synagogue or church? Why do we give to our local town or Rotary Club? I know it's because we want others to flourish. We want to create opportunities for flourishing legacies, whatever that might mean. So that's a whole world.
Some would say tax credits.
That's a piece. You know that, but it's not the only one.
No, it's not. I'm reminded, Doug, of the classic SWOT analysis, right? I went to business school and that was the classic day one sort of thing.
Sure.
And the challenge is that is inherently looking at what you're talking about. It's a fear-based analysis. You're looking at your weaknesses and your threats. And one of my mentors, John Berghoff, it may have come from David Cooper Ryder, who popularized the appreciative inquiry method, but he suggested another sort of analysis, which he calls a SOAR analysis, which is strengths, opportunities, aspirations, and results, which speaks to this sort of mindset of what could happen or how might we move to this positive place as opposed to trying to find the cheetahs lying in the brush.
And it's another good violent image, isn't it? About survival. So you know that David's background is an appreciative inquiry that started from how do we appreciate the beauty in a museum or an artwork or an action, whatever that might mean. I think it's a good start, but I don't think he's far enough. And he'd probably say that as well, because SOAR is a good model. And it's a good example of how could we measure Hector's capacity as a podcaster, as a thinker, as a consultant in the world. I'd be inclined to say it's probably pretty infinite. You could click on your favorite AI tool. Last night, I created a GPT for myself called Gray Matters, and it can do a SWOT in a millisecond for any business, any sector, any time. May or may not be accurate for yours, but the fact is, I don't need to do that kind of work anymore. Neither do any of your business school classmates. The routine activities do require other skills, and that's what we're talking about. So I know from research, there's two skills, competencies that you and I and everybody listening need to manifest in the spirit of AI because machines can never replace them. I've got my two. You want to guess before I tell you what they are?
My brain was always like critical thinking and creativity, but I feel like that's not it. So I'm curious to hear yours.
Right, because machines can do so much of that so much faster and have a 400x capacity. Yeah. The current research indicates that curiosity is something that can never be replaced by a machine, and humility is something that can never be replaced by a machine. So let's just presume somehow that Hector manifests those two competencies this afternoon, both curiosity and humility, somehow. Well, that makes you distinctly human and always will. What does that mean in the business world? If we get curious about our clients' needs, segment their needs and articulate what they might be, and demonstrate humility enough that we can become partners to them in some capacity, it's going to reshape every business I'm aware of.
It's interesting how this idea of change management, I think you're spinning a lot of plates, right? One is the plate of the individual, and I better to think of it as a gear. You have these little gears of individuals that make up this larger system. Do you see them as connected? Are they separate but parallel? Like when you're thinking about helping an organization improve their organizational efficiency, how much is it the individual's vision and habits and productivity, and how much of that is taken from the individual's perspective?
I love this question. And I love the fact that you're creating theoretical models and trying to describe the plates, create that picture in your head. The short answer is yes. And the longer answer is if you have a Venn diagram with three levels, the individual, the team, and the organization, or society, or species are the three levels. And yes, they interact all the time. Another way to view that is who's driving the change? Doug is, or Hector is. My experience is that every millennial on the planet aspires to have an impact. I'm picking on millennials because our daughters are millennials. And they're articulate, they're expressive, educated, and having massive impact. Why? Because we encourage them to be outspoken and independent, contribute to their business so that they can serve others. Let's expand that. I mentioned that I'll give you two examples. So I wrote this book, Objectives and Key Results, in part because clients ask, what really works? How do you manage difficult people, not only IT people at Google and Silicon Valley, but diffuse, geographically articulate, independent people who are hard to get together? The short answer is figure out three objectives, figure out some KRs, some measures of those objectives that they can quantify and then review on a, say, quarterly basis. That's a cadence. It worked at Google and Intel, and it revolutionized Silicon Valley, and it led to the biggest transfer of wealth in human history to one geography in our country, to Silicon Valley. Why wouldn't it work in other sectors? And the short answer is it does. So this collaborative leadership is not just a theoretical model, it's a business model. OKR leadership is a thing. I've shared this with Fortune 500, 10,000 employees in auto salvage parts industry. Why? Because they needed a structure, and they were diffused geographically and otherwise. They all wanted to do their own thing. So they needed to collaborate, but they also needed to align with the objectives of the boss. So that's one example. The second example is family business leaders. So a model that I favor is five systems. I'm a systems theorist guy. And to your point, the individual circle is the middle. It's the most important. How does the individual fit in that family business or family enterprise? Hector, you probably know this, but 70% of our GDP is tied to family-owned businesses that could be as big as Cargill or as small as a mom and pop around the corner. 65% of our GDP, and some $74 trillion in wealth is being distributed right now from older folks to younger folks. The boomers who are sitting on the cash have maybe capital or physical assets as well as financial assets, and they're looking at their successors. So the questions for them become, how does this individual fit into the system, which is your question? And the short answer is they don't have a great picture. So my recent research is a 360 leadership assessment process that looks at the individual in four systems: the family system, business system, the ownership system, in a learning system. A learning system is the capacity that you've read about learning organizations, Peter Senge and others, is to the extent that they're willing to embrace new ideas. 100% of my clients are part of learning organizations. They wouldn't be clients otherwise. But most of the time, those individuals who are confused and really aspire to be tremendous leaders look to the family system and they're asked, patron or patriarch, what should I be doing here? Or matron or matriarch. Or they look to the business system. Could I work in the business? Should I work in the business? If I don't, what else do I do? And what's my role? Or they look to the ownership system, who owns the decision-making capacity, the risk and reward, and all that impact over time. We don't talk enough about the successes of privately owned and closely held businesses. But frankly, they're more impactful than the Fortune 500 or publicly traded. You maybe go to an MBA program in part and discuss those kinds of programs. Why? Because that's the data that's available to us. So you're probably coached at an MBA program to say, my primary role is to increase stakeholder value. That's true if you are in a subset of the American capital system. I'm not sure if it's 30% or what it is that's that representative group, but that's what you read about in Forbes and other magazines. What if we did a better job of recognizing that family wealth is distributed over generations? It's generational assets. What if we did a better job of studying that in the way I just described? So I love your question. I love the idea of focusing on the individual and those systems, because that's the backbone of social psychology, of industrial organizational psychology. As a father, I know it's the backbone of parenting. How does my kid kid fit into this world and have an impact? So I suspect that whatever models you and I discuss or embrace in the future is probably going to define business success for anybody listening to this podcast. There's a bunch of information at assessnextgen.com, just one of my URLs, or nextgenpeergroups.com that describes that research.
I'm going to give you another opportunity to say those websites again at the end. One thing emerged as you were talking about, and I thought it would be good to get your insight on this, is really ever, I've never heard anyone voice this, people saying that like humans aren't resources, right? The idea of like human resources is all of a sudden, it's like, it's not politically correct anymore. But I get what they're saying, because all of a sudden we can't treat people like simply a cog in a wheel, or it's not just a metal gear, it's a person. And so I'm curious if that's something that people are now catching on to, if you kind of believe in that sort of thing, or if we're just taking this politically correctness a little too far sometimes.
Boy, what a loaded question. I suspect there'd be a lot of different answers to that one. I've never liked the phrase human resource. Like you, I think it's silly. Why was it created? So that CPAs could quantify the cost of Doug doing work in that organization. Okay, let's admit that. And let's assume that Doug's capacity or potential or impact on the organization is pretty hard to quantify. There's the qualitative and quantitative measures of whatever you do on a daily basis. That mentality has led to what's often described as the scientific notion of management. How do we create more Ford cars on an assembly line at a faster speed and lower cost with more efficiencies over time? That's an important part of the scientific revolution. Let's not ignore it. It's the backbone of capitalism. Let's not ignore it. However, what I think we're hearing from disenfranchised, disempowered groups in the last 20, 30, 40 years, frankly, after the pill, after the 60s, when women could articulate their voices and have a strong or massive impact in the workforce, those voices encouraged other disenfranchised groups, Hispanics, Blacks, pick a group. All those affinity groups have redefined many organizations that I work with today. In fact, many of my clients say, if we don't have an affinity group that supports mental health, a prospect will look elsewhere. I'm old enough to remember when mental health was something you just never talked about. If somebody struggled with anxiety or depression or suicidal ideation, chemical dependency, that was a family secret or a personal secret. Not any longer. Now people have social and digital and physical tools to affiliate with one another and support one another in their quests. What does that mean? I think it means that all investors, all owners need to rethink how we were raised, because the biggest capacity of every organization is the potential of their people. Let's assume it's 60 to 80% of your operating expenses, and it's 100% variable. So if you have a lot of people who are not doing what you want them to do, you can get rid of them and hire others pretty quickly, which is why venture capitalists have jumped into so many organizations and look for a five-year return. And then they're gone and the organization is hollowed out. Let's assume instead that leaders look at you and me and anybody as people who can collaborate in infinite work groups in any way imaginable. You and I connected virtually. It's not like I'm going to shake your hand next week. You're in California. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee today. Virtual work groups have always redefined innovation. A classic example is back to World War II, when telehealth was provided in remote battlefields to our soldiers. Fascinating example, because it's what now, 60 years old, 80 years old. Yeah, we think telehealth is a cool thing that doctors have been doing because they couldn't get answers from their colleagues next door. So they text a picture to somebody from their med school. And those were not HIPAA compliant, by the way. I've had a lot of clients in the healthcare sector. And docs are often so frustrated with the rate of change in their capacity to get answers. They don't want to be told to do these protocols. However, what are some of the changes that you're seeing today? Decentralized healthcare, driven by decentralized insurance. So healthy folks pay less, sick folks would be expected to pay more, and the governments, state and federal, support all that transition. I suspect we're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see segmented business delivery from leaders who are pretty savvy, using more and more accurate data sets.
Yeah, if nothing else, it's going to be exciting. And I love that your approach at the beginning, that this is the slowest it's ever going to be. Fantastic insights. Doug, if people want to get deeper in your world, get connected with you, where's the best place to do that?
I'll give you a few different URLs, because I've been doing this work at least since 97, so I've got a bunch of different projects. One is action-learning.com, which is kind of the mothership. There are a bunch of blogs and articles and products and services that people can see. A second is assessnextgen.com, which is a 360 leadership assessment process for anybody working with family-owned businesses. Boards, for instance, don't know if the executive leadership team has the capacity to do their job. And yet, the board's mandated with making sure that the executive leadership team has that capacity. So we developed a 360 assessment process that's tremendous. It's two versions, family and non-family version. Non-family members outnumber family members. So that's why you need the two versions. From that work evolved into nextgenpeergroups, with an S at the end, .com. And nextgenpeergroups are because my clients asked, how can we support support our kids or the next gens who, and some are family, some are non-family, developed it last year and launched it in January this year. Phenomenal program with a bunch of books that I've written and digital content that's related. And another group that I'm affiliated with is called the familybusinessconsultinggroup.com. So the URL is thefbcg.com. And it's brilliant. We're the dominant leaders in North America. So there's 37, I think, consultants. Most are PhDs. All have as much passion as I do for working with family-owned businesses and deep interest in collaborating on various engagements. So there's four.
And we'll link all those up in the show notes, y'all, and you can check those out. Doug, I'm going to have to go back and listen to this a few times because the insights were, I was drinking from a fire hose. So I'm impressed what we got done here in less than a half an hour. So this is going to be a fantastic episode. For those of you who have stuck with us, we're forever grateful, obviously, for hanging out with us. And we would be appreciative of a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know someone who's scaling a business in the midst of that process, hit that share button and let's grow the tribe together. Go get connected with Doug, check out some of those projects. And as always, we appreciate you being here. We'll see you on the next one. Later, y'all.